Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. And today we have a special show to play in memory of Jim Tex Manheim, who died earlier this year in October. Tex will always be in our hearts and in the music. I hope you'll enjoy this replay of an episode from November 2023, when Tex came down to the studio to talk writing with me.
Look out, friends. Here's Leon. Take it away, boys. Take it away. Oh, everybody dance now.
Afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And today, I couldn't be happier to have Jim Manheim, also known around these parts as Tex, here in the studio with me. Tex, it seems strange in some ways to say, but welcome to Living Writer.
Well,
because you know it so well in all its Living Writerness.
The other side of the mic, yes. Well, welcome back, T. You were missed over the last month and a half.
Oh, thanks, Tex. That's what you get for falling off your bike, right? And thanks to Jason for engineering for us today. So Tex has agreed. I feel like I've been harassing you or at least pestering you for years to be on Living Writers, pretty much since the early days when you were engineering for the show. And now, I don't know how many years later it is, because it's keeping time isn't my strong like suit, but
there's a good idiom. Your strong suit.
Strong suit. I was going to ask how you come up with all of those. but anyway, I'm just so pleased. I'm so happy to be talking with you today, because you're someone who I know who's a working writer. You're a living writer. You qualify. And you also, you're a freelancer. You're a working writer.
Yes.
You make your living writing.
I have made a living writing for many years. The last time I was employed by another company was 2004 or 2005.
And was that the Ann Arbor Observer?
I was part-time later at the Observer. Okay. That was the allmusic.com.
Uh-huh.
And I'm still working for them as a freelancer.
What was important to you about... So you were always... Is it safe to say you were always writing?
I did other things at AllMusic, but basically 90% of what I do has always been writing.
Maybe we can go at this from two different directions. You arrived in Ann Arbor in 1988?
That is correct.
For school?
Yes.
So tell us about this, like how you got to Ann Arbor.
I came up here to get into a master's program in musicology at the U of M. I started out thinking that I wanted to be in academe, but then I actually started making a living as a writer and found that I really enjoyed that a lot more.
And musicology. So did you have a love for country music that was, because in your undergrad years, you found Loretta Lynn at your library.
I didn't grow up with country music at all. As an undergrad, I happened to check out a Loretta Lynn album, which I think we're going to be hearing one track from, and I was bowled over by it. Then later on, I lived in Chicago for 5 years after I graduated. And I lived in the Uptown neighborhood, which at that time, I don't know what it's like these days. I should go check it out. But at that time, it was kind of like the Hazeltucky of of Chicago. I mean, actually, there were people from all over the world there, but there were a lot of Southerners, and there were some great old country bars, including one called Carol's Speakeasy, where when there were fights would break out, this cadre of guys would sort of surround them and push them out the door like immune cells. So I got into it more then. I was working in record stores, and I was the only one who knew anything about country, so I ended up learning a lot more about it.
So in undergrad, you were in Massachusetts?
Yes.
For that? And how did you, like, what got you to check out that first Loretta Lynn album? Was it a class, or was it your own pursuit?
Like, boy, that was pretty much random. I just found it on the shelf in the Northampton Public Library, and I said, wow, that's a wild cover that is definitely different.
Can you describe it? Because I don't know the cover.
It's kind of...
Jason has the cover.
There you go. It has Loretta Lynn standing in front of this lilac bush in this long white dress. You know, it's definitely a relic of the 1970s.
Yeah, it's almost like the lighting on her is like it's a Lawrence Welk-esque image, but probably something earlier than that, too.
I think that's a fair point.
Because definitely Grand Old Opry-esque.
Yes.
That's
a good point.
You're going to know all of this. Like, who was the man that gave Dolly Parton her break, who had those shows there, you know, and he had a television show. Do you know?
Well, I mean, there was Porter Wagoner, and before that, there was a guy named Bill Owens.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Because I think it was Porter Wagoner who I was thinking of, who was brought her on his TV show.
And has a very distinctive appearance himself, yes.
Speaking of appearances. So I guess sometimes the cover does matter to get you to take a chance on an album or a book or something.
The graphics of this stuff have always fascinated me.
How so?
I mean, it's just, I don't know who, I don't even know if anybody's ever written about this, but the designers, I mean, it went through several phases, they did really capture the style of these people, which has been over the top at various points in history. But I don't know, the very first country LPs, which didn't come along until the late 50s, have these big concepts, you know, with these rich colors. And then I think they stopped spending so much money on them, but there were still interesting ones after that. There's a Kitty Wells album called After Dark, where she's walking down this city street and you see her from the back.
After Dark.
Yeah, exactly. In sort of twilight.
So do you think it was serendipitous that when after you graduated, you also, is it Tom T. Hall? Is it like after your college graduation?
Yes.
You went to an amusement park?
And I saw Tom T. Hall. Yeah, I was just getting interested in it at that point, and I heard him on the radio, from country radio from Springfield, Massachusetts. And I said, well, what the heck, I'm going to go to this at the amusement park in Agawam. And I was pretty much blown away by that.
And when you say that, like, can you describe the experience? Is it something like where you're definitely standing outside, you're walking up to a raised stage? Was it something like that?
There was a little amphitheater there. I believe it was seated.
Oh, okay.
But it was the songs more than the.
Yeah. Why? What about, because you're hearing not only the instruments, but the voice, as the main instrument in some ways.
Well, and the songwriting. The year that Clayton Delaney died. I remember the year that Clayton Delaney died. Nobody ever knew it, but I went out in the woods and I cried. It's about this guy who idolizes this banjo player who is a raging alcoholic, and his reaction after his death. I always wondered why Clayton never took, who seemed so good to me, never took his guitar and made it big in 10 OC. I thought, wow,
it's beautiful.
That's quite an encounter.
Yeah.
And people don't appreciate this stuff for its seriousness.
Because what year was this?
1980. Spring of 1980. That's when I graduated from college. So I'm an oldster.
Nah. Time is meaningless. But if we're thinking about country music, I guess in this era of time, was it were people not getting their due, like the songwriting, would you say? Like, I don't know, because I feel like Bob Wills has always loomed large, like certain people have, but maybe that's just in my, it's obviously just in my limited scope of how things.
Well, they've certainly been popular. I mean, yeah, Bob Wills is still the king, as Waylon Jennings put it. but as far as, you know, it's, I mean, in the 70s, people were starting to write about it. I don't think Rolling Stone, for instance, did a very good job of it, but they tried. And, I mean, they gravitated more toward things like Linda Ronstadt that had a rock aspect to it. But, you know, they did. It wasn't like it was completely ignored. But I don't think people really appreciated what a creative figure Dolly Parton was until many years later, or Loretta Lynn. I mean, but yeah, she was an enormous force in the culture. It's not like they were ignored.
And do you think for you, Tex, and with the music, it was the storytelling aspect of it, as well as like maybe the craft of how they told the story?
I think that's a fair statement. You know, Charlie Parker liked country music, and somebody asked him how he could stand it, and he said, "Man, listen to the stories."
Yeah. I've just listened recently to a podcast about Dolly Parton that Radiolab put out, and so I have a newfound, a newly ignited appreciation and respect for her, definitely.
Oh, gee, I'd like to hear that.
I think you'll love it. If you're looking for a podcast.
It was Radiolab. Interesting.
Yes.
Good for them.
And they did a separate serial. It was one of their Spur series off to the side.
Oh, yeah.
So did it feel, let's go to Chicago again. Now you've graduated, you're moving.
My life story, which is not that interesting.
No, well, don't say that, Tex, for one thing. And one thing, it's like the life of a writer, you know, because now you're on the move, you go to Chicago, you're working at a record store. And is it serendipitous then that you're the one in the shop that has any inkling of country music? Is that like how it kind of began growing even more? Or do you think it was already lit for you, this passion?
I don't think that at that time, I was getting more into it, but you know, everybody back then, this was early 80s, it was all alternative rock or new wave as it was called back then. So that was less, you know, that was less significant. Actually, I mean, I didn't even really think about becoming a writer. I'm not big on regrets, but if there's one thing I regret, before I worked at the record store, I worked at the Walgreen drugstore at State and Elm, and people from all over the city worked there. And man, if I had thought of being a writer, I could have written novels about that place, because everybody had, I mean, I don't even know where I would start. I could tell you about how I violated federal law, but I'm pretty sure
the statute of limitations limitations
is over. Yeah, there was this this Ethiopian gal who I got to be friends with, because really I was the only one with the patience to try to understand her. And so she said, "Well, my cousin is coming over here." Well, she said, "My cousin is coming over here, and we have a sponsor, but we can't reach him on the phone. So could you impersonate him?" So I said, I'm the world's worst liar. There's no way I can do this. But after persuading me for a week, I gave in. And
was it over the phone or in person?
It was over the phone to Addis Ababa, to the American Embassy in Addis Ababa. And I pulled it off, and I got to go to the airport with her and pick up the cousin who got off the plane with these three big boxes of Ethiopian spices. And they took me back to her apartment, and they cooked me the greatest meal I've ever eaten in my life. I was like sitting there eating for 4 hours. I mean, it was an amazing thing. It's still there, I believe. The restaurant that they opened.
Oh, they opened a restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, I thought you meant the Walgreens for a second.
Yeah, the Walgreens is still there too. I mean, there were funny things and there were tragic things, and it was one block from the Gold Coast, which is the wealthiest neighborhood in Chicago, and four blocks from the former Cabrini Green housing project, which was the poorest and most violent. And representatives of both worked there. So I wish I had written some of that stuff down.
What do you think about it being material that you already have and that you could possibly use? Because sometimes with distance, you might write about it now.
That's an interesting idea. I mean, now that I'm approaching retirement age, I have to shift my perspective from what will make a living to what might be better to set down for other reasons.
Well, Tex, let's talk about more of the things that as a freelancer and as a writer you've done before we talk about your retirement. But we shall. That can be like, let's talk about that later. So one of the long running things that you've been part of is the Encyclopedia of World Biography. And now you're the editor.
Yes.
But you still write entries.
I do. I started, that was really... You know, the country music really happened in stages. I got into it more when I was in graduate school and actually in California, and I was not having a good time, and I would drive out to the big country dance halls in the Central Valley just to get away from it.
So wait, after Chicago? See, this I yeah, missed was, this whole piece. So let's continue with the life story
that
a little
was,
bit,
that
too.
Was after
so you
Chicago.
Drove further west. You went to
I
California.
I went to UC Berkeley.
For grad school.
Yeah, that was before I came here.
In musicology as well?
Yeah.
Okay. With an area of interest in country music? Or?
Well, no. At that time, I was sort of studying Renaissance music.
Oh, interesting. And so, not too far from the polka. No.
Yeah, a long way from the polka. But...
And you would go to those dance halls when you were... Yeah, pick up their tax.
Well, that's... I mean, that grew in... So that was... The whole country music thing kind of grew in stages. And then it grew a lot once I started doing it on WCBN. But as far as the writing goes, while I was in school here, I answered two things happened. One was at the Observer. I wrote this little sketch. I got a summer job with doing their city guide. They hire researchers to do their city guide every each summer. And I wrote this little thing for it about the Cloverleaf Diner. And which was there until recently, but is now no longer there. And this, I talked to this big Greek who was the owner, and he told me his life story. I mean, he came over. A lot of Greeks came here after World War II, and he got a job at the White Hut in downtown Toledo, and he saw this gangland style killing down there on Monroe Street. He said, "Man, I've got to get out of here and find a more peaceful place.
Too dangerous."
So that is how he ended up in Ann Arbor. And I said, "Wow, this world is full of stories." And I said, "Are you kidding? You know, I can do this and get paid." So that was the big moment. Then the other thing was I answered an ad
Tex, could I ask a follow-up question on
sure.
that one? So for the Cloverleaf, when you did the piece for the Observer, for City Guide, were you able to actually work in some of his life story as well as tell about the Cloverleaf itself, like what someone might find there?
Oh, yeah. I told him about that. I mean, the Observer, those little sketches are... They accommodate that kind of material. I put most of it in.
It's kind of encouraged, right? These vignettes of the people and places.
Very much. I mean, if somebody writes a story about parks, they tell part of the story of it.
Yeah. Okay, so the second thing then, I can get paid for this.
Yeah, I answered an ad from Gale, the encyclopedia publisher, which at that time was in downtown Detroit. And I wrote two biographical sketches. One was of John Hyatt, and one was of Nile Rodgers of Chic. And I had a really good time with those, and I turned them in on time. So after that, I got more and more work from them, and I'm still getting it, you know, what, 20, 25 years later.
Wow. But you kept it as like a freelance, you kept it as a freelance gig.
It was a freelance gig while I was in school.
And then because I feel like, is that important to you to kind of keep some sort of freedom? Because here at WCBN, of course, we're all about free form. But was it something where you felt like this is a way I can put things together that I love doing without having to have like something that was like the thing that took all the time? Or
that's a good question. I mean, to answer it generally, I would say most freelance writers would probably say, yes, I do this for the freedom. I'm never going to make as much money as other people do. But my office is wherever I feel like it being on any given day.
Yeah.
At that time, I mean, yeah, I definitely at that time I was balancing a lot of things. And I thought, you know, if I write something and somebody pays me for it, that's a good day. And if I write something about music and somebody pays me for it, that's a really good day. So at that point, I mean, I had other freelance jobs. I was an editor at the art museum for a while. And then this allmusic.com came along. They moved down from Big Rapids. They had this weird database guy named Michael Erlewine up there, and they moved down here. They realized that these databases were marketable. So I took a job there and worked there for 5 years. And I thought one of two things will happen. Either Bill Gates will buy this and we'll all be millionaires. This was in the first internet boom. Or it will fail magnificently. And what I did not foresee was that I would still be doing work for them, you know, 25 years later.
Yeah, you keep these relationships going. Like, yeah,
I think a lot of writers do that.
Let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Today on Living Writers, Jim Manheim,
otherwise known as Tech,
is here in the studio. We've got Jason behind the glass. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
I remember the year that Clayton Delaney died. They said for the last 2 weeks that he suffered and cried. It made a big impression on me, although I was a barefoot kid. They said he got religion at the end, and I'm glad that he did. Clayton was the best guitar picker in our town. I thought he was a hero, and I used to follow Clayton around. I often wondered why Clayton, who seemed so good to me, never took his guitar and made it down in Tennessee. Well, Daddy said he drank a lot, but I could never understand. I knew he used to pick up in Ohio with a five-piece band. Clayton used to tell me, son, you better put that old guitar away. Ain't no money in it, it'll lead you to an early grave. I guess if I'd admit it, Clayton taught me how to drink booze. I can see him half-stoned to picking out the lovesick blues.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did, because today Jim Manheim is here in the studio, Tex, as we all call him. I think, Tex, when I saw you once in the Carytown Market by the fish market and my mom was visiting, right, I think I yelled across, there's Tex. And then we walked away. Mom was like, now, that gentleman's name is Tex, is it? And I was like, that's right. I didn't know your real name at that point, even.
Well,
like, Tex is larger than life.
That worked the other way, too, is that I have, down through the years, been visited by people who never knew me as Tex. And they say, who are these people and why are they calling you Tex?
Right, exactly. Because you're not from Texas.
Right? I am not from Texas. That was just a purely fanciful joke that arose early in the show. I mean, there was no particular reason.
It just feels right, though.
Yeah, I mean.
It feels. And now people across the globe, from listening to for years for the Bill Monroe for Breakfast. And well, you started on the Down Home Show.
Yes, that was correct. That was 1980, fall of 1988. After I moved here, I worked at Borders, and the husband of one of my coworkers was a host of the Down Home Show, which goes back to the early 70s. And he had to leave the show for work reasons. So they recruited me to replace him.
And was that the original? Was that the flagship Borders that you worked in?
Yes,
in 88?
Store One. Yep.
Store One. Okay.
Certainly. I met a lot of people there. It certainly left an impact on me working there.
And are many of the people who were there still in town?
A lot of them are. Some of them went into, a lot of them worked for the corporate Borders and a bunch of them work now for the bookstore down on Fourth Avenue.
Literati. Oh, Literati. Yeah. Oh, great. Yeah. Oh, that's good to hear. Okay. Well, before we get too far away from it, because I do want us to talk about your DJing and also the use, like, sound design of these programs through the years with the Bill Monroe for Breakfast, Down Home Show, and the Drive Time Polka Party. But first, Tom T. Hall, as we just got to hear at the break. And that was the musician that you saw at the amusement park.
Yeah.
Right?
If I had to pick one country songwriter other than Hank Williams, it probably would have been him. He was just a total original. His death, he just died last year.
Oh, he did.
That one hit me hard. I mean, otherwise, I'm not, you know, that big on memorials. I sort of live in the moment musically. But
yes.
But that one was very sad to me. He's, some of his songs were my theme songs for the show down through the years. And he's written a lot of songs that just, they sound as good as the first day they came out. I don't know how I can.
They're lasting.
Yeah, they're lasting. I don't know how I can capture it without going into a great deal of detail, but he's a wonderful songwriter.
Thank you for choosing one of those so that we could hear it today.
Great.
Thinking back now, we were talking about your time writing the Encyclopedia of World Biography. Do you have, because this is something that you're now the editor of,
yeah,
as we mentioned, and you still write entries for, could you talk a little bit about, because this is ongoing work and why you do it, like what you get from it as a writer, I guess.
Well, you know, there are a lot of biographical encyclopedias in libraries, and the ones that Gale puts out have never been the most prestigious ones. You know, it's a big corporation, and it was a big corporation then, and it's a bigger corporation now, and the primary goal of people who work there is to get the stuff going through the pipeline so they don't get fired. But the upside of it is that they tend to do, it's easier to do very timely stuff there. I remember for a while I wrote for the Contemporary Black Biography. First I did Contemporary Musicians, which was the Nile Rodgers one. They moved over to Contemporary Black Biography. I wrote a lot of those, and I wrote the very first reference book article that was ever written about Barack Obama.
I
noticed newspaper articles cribbing from this for years. Journalists know about these encyclopedias.
And not citing you as a source.
Well, it's an encyclopedia. They don't have to cite me, but I was okay. I wasn't teed off. I was kind of pleased to hear my words, you know,
right.
Continuing to. And people read these things, you know, the if you go to the library and say, hey, I have to do a bio of Eminem, that's what the librarian will give you. And I updated a bio of Eminem, actually. And he went to Osborne High School on the east side of Detroit. And the original bio that I was updating had spelled this O-S-B-O-U-R-N-E, like Ozzy Osbourne. but it's actually O-S-B-O-R-N. And this was early in the days of the internet. I started doing this even before the internet. And at that time, there were about 100,000 pages about M&M, and of those, 8,000 of them mentioned where he went to high school, and of those, 7,000 spelled it wrong. And so that's obviously where they got the information, was from our skit.
Right, right.
So it's kind of satisfying, and that, you know, I write these things, and a lot of people read them. That's all any writer can really ask.
Yes, and you're actually a guardian for the facts as well. As you even, whether you're creating them like Obama's or updating them like M&M's.
Yeah, we try to be. We certainly have made mistakes, but...
Do you have a...
It's the first draft of history, as they say. I didn't coin that phrase. I don't know who did coin that phrase. Journalism is the first draft of history.
It's one step
beyond journalism in that... Often we would do them by, you know, there would be an article somewhere, like for contemporary Black biography, there would be an article in Essence or something like that. And then we would try to find something from their hometown newspaper, and then we would write a little biographical sketch. And then if the person became very famous, that would be the first one.
I like hearing you talk about this, as opposed to sometimes when you hear people talk about obituary writers, where for anyone who's moderately famous, some places have the draft sketch obits waiting in the wings. You know,
that's right.
Which seems, I guess, you're still making a tribute or capturing the essence of someone in a way, but it feels nice to have it. I don't know. I guess it also feels old-fashioned, doesn't it, to have an encyclopedia rather than the World Wide Web, like this idea of an encyclopedia.
Well, at the time, they were only print. They would go right on the reference shelves in the library. They're probably still there. And they printed it until fairly recently. By now, they're completely online.
Completely. Do you have some? Did you want to read a sample from one of these for us, or something that?
I could read a little bit of one. Some of them have just stuck in my head over the years. And if you have been to Columbus,
Ohio,
there's this artist there who's pretty well known. There. I think most people interested in art down there know about her. But and when I wrote this, she had just gotten a MacArthur grant.
Oh, wow.
But at that time, she was very little known outside of Columbus. And her name was Amina Brendolyn Robinson. And so this is how I started it out. Quote, "For me, art is not a job or a career," Columbus, Ohio artist Amina Robinson told the Cleveland Plain Dealer. "It's a way of life, always has been," unquote. Many artists live by a similar credo, but few have immersed themselves in art as intensely as Robinson, who is reported to rise at 4 a.m. to begin work and to continue working until midnight or beyond. Robinson works in her Columbus home and a small backyard structure she calls the dollhouse. It would be inaccurate to say that Robinson has a studio, for her home is a studio and sometimes a medium. She makes art from scraps of material that she finds or that people bring to her from doors, walls, porch components, and even floors. Her kitchen floor is a complex mosaic of materials that includes the baby teeth of her son, who committed suicide at age 27. Yet Robinson's art has not focused primarily upon her own life. Rather, she is creatively rooted in a specific place to a degree matched by few other artists. Quote, "My work and life are about Columbus, Ohio, the community, ancestors, and spirits," Robinson told the Cincinnati Inquirer. Her thousands of works are made from an astonishing assortment of materials, including fabric, needlepoint, paint, ink, charcoal, plastic, metal, glass, clay, a huge miscellany of found objects, animal skins obtained from a Columbus slaughterhouse, and a concoction called hog mog that her father taught her to make from mud, pig grease, red clay, crushed brick, sticks, and glue. Many of them show scenes of Columbus life, past and present, often focusing on Robinson's east side neighborhood of Poindexter Village. Considered a community treasure by Columbus art lovers, Robinson was gradually discovered by the wider art world. She was awarded a $500,000 MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant in the year 2004. So this one was really cool to write because, I think this was the first time anybody had written a reference book article about her.
And so you really have this sense of, like, you're trailblazing when you're capturing, trying to capture a person on paper
sometimes,
as best you can, or on screen.
Sometimes they're boring, but some of
this
them
aren't. This one certainly was not. This was
one of the wilder ones.
I mean, this is so vivid.
Yeah.
Text.
This one was really fun to work on.
So when you write one like this, is this something that you think, oh, I could be, like, I could write a book about her, or I could write a longer piece, maybe pitch it to the New Yorker as a portrait or a profile, or would you want to interview the person herself and build something like a longer piece? Because it already sounds like you're engaging so much and with her life.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, yeah, that's crossed my mind. You know, it's hard to make the leap from, you know, I've never had the money to take a year off. Wanda Jackson, I did a bio of Wanda Jackson. Well, maybe now somebody has, but the last time I looked, nobody ever wrote a bio of Wanda Jackson. And, you know, she was Elvis's girlfriend. She has many, many stories to tell.
Yes. Yeah.
So I did think, gee, somebody should write a bio of her and maybe it should be me. But I never did it.
Well, that could be one of the future projects then.
That's possible. Yeah.
And also, I think we should go to break and hear another one of the songs. Thanks for choosing them.
Absolutely.
For today, Tex.
Sure.
But I wanted to say, so I didn't forget, what about a Tom T. Hill book? Because he's just passed away recently. And wouldn't that go... I feel like you're going to be writing a book before you leave here today, Tex. Because
I'm glad I brought my computer.
You've got Living Writers today on the program. Tex is here. Jim Manheim. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass, and we'll be back.
You want me to come down to your level? You know that's pretty low. It looks like I will soon be there, 'cause I don't have very far to go. You turn my feet in your direction and I follow everywhere. So when I reach the bottom, you'd better be there. I'm going down the ladder, one step at a time. You're teaching me your way of life, and it didn't take me very long to learn. I'll do anything you want me to. I've got to where I don't care. But when I reach the bottom, you'd better be there.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, glad you did. Today, here in the studio, Jim Manheim, Tex. Max, as we all know him here at WCBN, is here in the studio. Tex, you said like we're talking about your life story, and I hope that's okay, because even though you said it's not like you've been writing your whole life, it feels like between music and ideas and writing, it's all been swirling around you. Like, I feel like Loretta could write a song about you.
Well, I would say, and, you know, you're someone from a university English department.
Well, not really. Sweetland Center for Writing.
Okay. Well, I mean, but...
Adjacent.
Related to the written word.
Right, right.
And, you know, yes, you're quite right. The fact that I was given the ability to patiently explain what I mean about a piece of music certainly grew from my having studied classical music and musicology. I had an unusual undergraduate major. You can actually major in music history and theory at Amherst College, which is, it's modeled on the old German university system, but most schools don't do that. I mean, they exist to service performers. I think that's a fair statement. It certainly grew out of that.
And thanks for picking Loretta Lynn for today.
That is an intense song. When I reach the bottom, you'd better be there. You keep saying, come on down, and like a fool, I ask you where. What in her life did that grow out of? That is an intense song. It still amazes me when I hear that song.
And what part, because she was singing and working from such a young age. So I wonder, do you know what part of her career that song was from? And the picture, she looks young to me, but people look younger all the time now to me.
Well, she had been around for a few years. That album is from the early 70s. So it was after, you know, the big hits that put her on the map. You know,
like the Coal Miner's Daughter.
It was around the same time as Coal Miner's Daughter.
Okay.
So she was clearly in a pretty creative period.
Yeah. Yeah. It's beautiful, like, to have these stories, story, poem, songs. Let's pivot to something that maybe is less poetic, or maybe not. Maybe people might want to argue that. But before we came on the air, we were kind of chatting and joking a little bit about ChatGPT.
ChatGPT, yes.
And your bio text, tell me about this.
Well,
like,
when this came out,
let's do some AI stuff here.
back when everybody was fooling with it.
Yeah,
I had it write a bio of me, and it had me dying in the year 2021.
Oh no! this is grim indeed.
Well,
you're back.
on one hand, it's grim. On the other hand, it's, yes, I'm back. Somebody said, I look forward to your resurrection.
And
I said,
are.
It's going well.
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, the upside is that, you know, obviously many writers are wondering whether they're going to be out of a job soon. And I think that I probably can last long enough not to have this bring me to a crisis point in my life. But, you know, the people coming after me, who knows? But it sure ain't there yet.
By the time, it feels like in some of the work that you've done in the past, you're the one that would be like, hey, yes, like completely incorrect, because you'd have the facts that you'd researched and you'd change it anyway.
I have noticed from time to time in just in writing these bios, and other people have told me this too, it gets to a certain point and it's fine. And then when it draws a blank, it just starts making things up. And that sounds like a difficult programming challenge to stop it from doing that. I don't know. Maybe they'll find a way to stop it from doing that. But that's what it did with me. There was another James Mannheim who died in 2021, and it picked that up.
Oh, so pulled it in. Yeah.
And it was clearly not the same one. He was a furniture dealer. But it did not have the sophistication to grasp that.
And there wasn't any furniture floating earlier in the bio to signal that this could be
none
ahead.
Whatsoever. Okay. At that point, it just started throwing in nice things to say about me.
Oh, well, Well, we'll end on that positive note with it, because I guess all writers have to reckon with it in some way. And maybe I'm completely naive. It's not out of the realm of reason, I suppose. But I think the ideas that we've been talking about before, I don't know. I think because, for example, for your connection with Tom T. Hill, from hearing about how the intersections even in your life, like from that that moment, because Commencement Day is a big day in people's lives. Like it's a marker, you know. And that moment, that day included an amusement park trip where you heard this person who has a gift with words and stories. And that changed who you were in some way.
Yes.
And then hearing how you said he's just died recently, and me being here and everyone able to hear in your voice what that means to you. You are someone that could be a steward of writing something that does justice to this person, because there would be these layers within it that I don't believe there's enough content been fed into the machines yet.
It would be hard.
That could happen, because you are you. And obviously Tom T. Hill is him.
Well, and how could it grasp? He did some really experimental stuff in the 1970s, which other people were doing in country music at the time.
How
it
so?
Rained in every town except Paducah. And then one day it rained in Paducah, too. And it tells this story of, I mean, it's a rather painful thing about this guy who's wandering around the country and getting these different jobs, building, installing stovepipes in Ohio. And then he goes to Atlanta. It doesn't rain too much, but there's a constant mist. And it's not a typical country song lyric. And it hints at this lost romance without going into it. It never seemed to rain when you were with me, but I guess I just didn't notice rain back then. But it just mentions that obliquely. And he did a lot of songs, you know, they weren't terribly successful commercially, but yeah, I could probably write a song about his lyrics.
Or like a book.
Maybe I should do that. I mean, yeah, I could probably do it. You know, I'm not a Christian, but he came on the charts with a song called "Me and Jesus," and it talks about this guy who went out and made an altar out of a stump. The credos of Protestantism have rarely been so concisely and elegantly stated.
He means something to you, clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very few down-home shows went by without my playing one of his songs. Or Johnny Cash, too.
How hard was it to, like, I don't know, as a listener I know it was hard, but how hard was it for you and for Bob on that day when you, like, it rolled around and it was your, like, official last down-home show?
You know, I'm moving on to another phase of my life. Certainly, it was, you know, I guess it was hard to reach the decision to, you know, I delayed and dilly-dallied in announcing that I was going to stop. And then it was, you know, it reached a point where, to be fair to the other people who might be involved, I had to do it. That was where I hesitated. The last day, again, there were any number of ways I could have done that last show. I ended up with this song called "They All Faded Away" by Robin and Linda Williams. You know Robin and Linda Williams? You would like them. But, you know, I guess I sort of reached the point where I said, you don't overthink this. It is what it is. And as I say, I'm not that... I don't really have a strong orientation toward, you know, I could have tried to pick my 30 favorite country songs, but tomorrow they would have been a different 30. So it wasn't, certainly.
I think people know that about you, Tex, because over the years, because do you see it as like the years of Down Home Show? Like it's this this music, like different times when you were playing different artists. Like you said, there was hardly a down-home show where you wouldn't play some Johnny Cash in it, or, you know, like these threads throughout for you, like these voices become sort of how you're shaping and crafting down-home show. Because these experiences for listeners, like people tune in from all over the world.
Well, I think that treating it, I mean, you know from being around the station, some people plan out every second of their shows and some people breeze in here with no idea of what they're going to do until 30 seconds before the show starts. And either one of those can work. I always mixed it up. I mean, I would have a half a dozen things that I wanted to, half a dozen or 10 things that I wanted to play or say, and then the rest would be spontaneous. And a big part of that was a dialogue with the listeners who would call in, and that was lost during the pandemic, of course. But I think I did manage to kind of catch something that was in the air on a good day. You know, it was very difficult to do radio after 9/11, for instance, but I did do a real tragic show and somebody called in and said, man, you really nailed that. And, you know, some otherwise they were happier things. And yeah, I think leaving it somewhat unstructured was overall a good thing.
Because then you responded to the moment,
yeah,
like you said.
And it might take me down a byway of my own mind or of those of other people.
And the thing is also, since, I mean, if we're thinking about it, since when you found that Loretta Lynn album, you've been having this, you've been finding new music and exploring and learning. That's who you are as a person and as a musicologist.
Boy, absolutely. I mean, for many years, I spent a lot of time in junk shops and, you know, talk about the first draft of history. I was pulling stuff off the scrap heap of history for both the country and the polkas. I bought a large lot of hundreds of polka records from this old Pole in Toledo named Frank in the old Polish village on LaGrange Street. And, you know, man, those would have gone in the crusher if it hadn't been for me. And they're right back there in the cage right now.
Because that became the drive time polka party.
Exactly. And I read this kind of Marxist essay called In Pursuit of Polka Happiness by Charles Kyle. That was the intellectual genesis of that show. And unlike most of the Marxists, he could really write well. And I said, gee, you know, this is interesting. 40 years ago, this music was on major labels like Columbia and RCA, and now it is almost completely forgotten. So it's worth figuring out what it's about.
And it never fails to make me feel happier. Even if it's not like all the lyrics are cheerful, even because you play such like the folks that are also becoming part of this show.
Yeah.
Like it's a range, but there is something about it where I'm like, oh, thank goodness it's polka.
Yeah.
It's the polka.
No question about it.
Yeah.
Polka happiness.
It's
is
true.
What it is.
I feel like I've called you a lot during the polka.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And have you heard? I'm delighted. I feel deep satisfaction that people picked that show up after I was leaving.
Yes. So it's ongoing.
I'm overjoyed about that.
It's part of your legacy here,
yeah,
in Tex.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's, which is kind of a beautiful thing, because you and Bob did that for Bill Monroe for Breakfast when the Funky Farmer,
yeah,
who started that show, left.
That is true. I would say that I just heard from him, and he's now doing a bluegrass show on WOUB in Athens, which is a big deal. I mean, there are a lot of bluegrass shows down there, but that one was either started or done for decades by this guy named Ivan Tribe, who was one of the great scholars of old time music and bluegrass. And so for him taking that over is a big deal. Yeah. And because we gave him his start on the Down Home show when he was an undergrad. So, again, those things fit together. Yes, we picked up the bluegrass show from him. But we also gave him a break on the radio when he was a very green DJ indeed.
Do you have any things like advice about either it sounds like you've talked about how you walk into, for example, a Down Home show, you know, and the polka maybe too, the Drive Time polka. Do you have anything you want to say for folks that are, I don't know,
for aspiring DJs?
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah. I don't know. You know, the things that the station normally tells new DJs are certainly accurate. You know, explore the library, and, you know, you're here to learn about things that you might otherwise not know about. But a certain degree of spontaneity, and I'm not a very spontaneous person, but a certain degree of, the way to get from good radio to great radio is to have a certain degree of spontaneity and to trust yourself to do that.
Do you feel like you are also like, because you are who you are, Tex, right? Are you like when you're behind the mic, does it feel like you're even more you?
I don't know about even more, but it certainly was an unpredictable thing. And that's good. I could have a show that I thought, really, I found all these great new records at the Goodwill, and I've really got these sets down. And then I would get on the air, and it would come out kind of stilted. And sometimes it would just be sheer serendipity, and I would have these segues that were amazing. And, it is serendipity.
Yeah. And, because it also reminds me of when I first saw you in action for the fundraiser, the annual fundraiser.
Yeah, those were something, weren't they?
I mean, you are like my model, but I know I would never be as good as you.
Well, it was true. Those revealed parts of my personality that I didn't know were there, because that was sales. I thought, you know, a nightmare job for me would be auto salesman or something, because you have to be, you know, just pure dishonesty. But that, for that,
but when it's something
somehow,
you love,
yeah,
when it's something
somehow
you love,
I managed to pull that off. I'm still not sure exactly how that worked.
Well, I know, Tex. It's because you love this place, and it's such a part of these years since you got here to Ann Arbor. And thank goodness that colleague from Borders.
Yeah, but
pulled you in.
It was, you know, but it was so over the top sometimes. And that, you know, the interactions between Bob and I and
yes.
me, I don't yes. think anybody could really, we're not like that in daily life. It's like this comedy routine.
It
I mean,
is.
I understand how the great comedy teams worked. Very early.
Shout out to Bob.
Yeah, shout out to Bob. Very early on, there was this show called Uncle Ed's Album Hour, done by this guy named Carl Palachuk. And the idea would be that Uncle Ed could not come in, so Carl would be the sub. And then we would tell these tall tales about what was happening to Uncle Ed. And I subbed for that show once, and that was like stand-up comedy. And boy, I see why people get hooked on stand-up comedy. I'm sure I didn't do it very well, but that was a rush of adrenaline like I've never felt before.
Tex, thanks for today. Thanks for everything that
thanks
you've,
for having me.
You've been part of Living Writers family and always will be, and this and WCBN family and always will be. And I hope you always feel the love that's coming to you.
Thank you. That means a lot to me.
And thanks to Jason for engineering today. Today on Living Writers, Jim Mannheim. We all know him as Tex, and you probably do too. Thanks for listening today. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
shovel and I shovel and I shovel that snow. I gotta get out by the
Keep
car.
Cool with WCBN-FM, Ann Arbor.
Windows. I gotta get out, but my car won't go. I shovel and I shovel and I shovel that snow.
Polka, polka, polka radio.
All right. That's a pretty dang hard act to follow. Holy cow. Thanks, T and staff, for rerunning that episode of Living Writers. That was... I'm not crying, you're crying. We miss Tex. And today is 1 hour of Christmas polka music, and we certainly will be digging in the cage in the Tex Mannheim Polka Collection, which now lives here at the station. My name is DJ Ish, and I'm hoping I can fill some big shoes. So let's listen to a little bit more Bobby Vinton while I collect myself. Thanks so much for listening, and let's have some fun. Let's have a Christmas polka party.
I love my radio, my polka radio. It cheers me up when